Welcome to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. I'm your host, Joseph Miller. Tom Whitaker, drama professor for UCSB's Department of Theater and Dance, is directing Will Eno's Middletown, a play which draws inspiration from Thornton Wilder's Our Town, yet is stamped with the insignia of a playwright who has been called by the New York Times a Samuel Beckett for the John Stewart generation. An essential shorthand for the play might be read in a Facebook meme Whitaker came across recently. Quote, "I'm in that awkward stage of life between birth and death." Performed by 12 actors and set in mid-20th century Middle America, the play infuses the quaint relationships and familiar irksomeness of small-town life with the unsettling big questions that gnaw at the psyche from underneath. I met with Whitaker recently, 2 weeks before the opening of Middletown, in his office. I'm very happy to have with me today on Direct Talk the director, Tom Whitaker. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here. Thank you for talking this morning.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
So you must be right here on the cusp. I'm speaking with you on Halloween,
right,
by the way.
Oh, yes.
And we're not in costume, or maybe we're, according to Eno, we all are.
That's right. We all are, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. Which actually reminds me that I should at some point mention how I think this play has something to do with Shakespeare. Reflecting nature and us all playing parts and all that kind of stuff. But
oh, good. Yeah. Well, we're not far off with the Halloween.
Yeah, we're
reference.
Not far off. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were entering right now the really intensive final 2 weeks, and
Right. You
get that feeling of, can we pull this off? Is it all going to come
always,
together?
Always, always. It always does, and I know we will, but it is a kind of period of gelling, and I think we've been working on this show since, design has been working on this show since the middle of last summer, and then we've been rehearsing the past... what is that? I guess 4.5 weeks or something like that now. And have a lovely cast. And yeah, it's the time when you really have laid, hopefully, all the groundwork, and you're trying to get the thing to gel and trying to find the right tempos for things and kind of crystallize things. And it's an exciting time, absolutely.
Do you want to tell me about some of the casts that you've got?
Yeah. This is sort of a post-Beckett Our Town. One can think of it as a post-Beckett Our Town. And indeed, Eno was influenced or inspired a bit by Our Town. But it's not Our Town. It's very contemporary. Basically, there is a town called Middletown, which is in the middle of America, not necessarily in Ohio or Iowa or Kansas or anything like that, but really a kind of central location, I think, and central not only east and west, but actually kind of up and down, strangely. If you can imagine a kind of Cartesian graph with axes, three axes, right? Middletown is probably right at the intersection of those axes. And so there's east coast and west coast and north and south, but there's also a kind of verticality in the play where in Our Town, the last act really is about eternity and so on and so forth. And in this play, they're not quite sure who's up there, but they did have an astronaut from this town that
went
up there. And below the town are two other middle towns that have existed in history, and then prior to that, a village called Middenton. And below that, the Chakmaw, which is, as far as I know, a completely fictitious name, Indian village lay. And so it's a kind of interesting verticality to the play, as well as a horizontal aspect. And in this town, there's a cop, there's a librarian, there's an astronaut, there are these people, a mechanic. And these are the people really that Eno started with when he was writing the play. And he wanted to write a play that included these denizens of the town. And this went through several variations, I guess. And when it started to finally work for him, he kept all these characters, but he had also a man named John Dodge, who is in the town, who's sort of between gigs, between jobs, very much in the middle, that awkward place in the middle where you're not.
He has a joke where he's between two bad jobs.
Two bad jobs, and he hasn't found out what the second one is yet. Right. And then the inciting incident of the play is really that a woman named Mary Swanson comes to Middletown to start a family with her husband, and I don't think it's giving too much away to say that somehow her husband never shows up. He's always elsewhere, but she's showing up to start a family and have children there, and she and John Dodge have a sort of interesting relationship, which is, I would say it's like an almost affair. You know, there's a lot that happens between them, a lot of chemistry. If you know Three Sisters with Vershinin and Masha, you know, Masha is one of the three sisters who lives in this remote Russian town, kind of like Middletown, only in the middle of Russia, maybe. And then the troops come through and Vershinin, the captain, comes and they fall in love and have an affair. Well, here, maybe the affair doesn't quite happen, but the relationship happens. Mm. So casting,
which is a kind of being stranded in the middle,
it
as
is,
well.
Yes, it absolutely is. Yes, absolutely is. As a matter of fact, someone posted on Facebook the other day. You know how people have those sort of, they're like little electronic posters with slogans and stuff.
Yes.
Right. It said, "I'm in the awkward place between birth and death." And I thought, well, that really is it. You know, none of us know quite what to do, really. We're kind of improvising our way through here. So actors, John Dodge is played by Ian Elliott, who's a senior. The mechanic is played by Dylan Francis, who's also a senior. The cop is played by Rigo Sanchez, who's a junior. And then there is a graduate student, Tristan Newcomb, who is playing the public speaker at the beginning of the play, Greg the astronaut, and the male doctor, who is the doctor that advises Mary Swanson on the birth of her baby. And then there are a couple other actors, Adrian Carter and Roberto Tolentino, who play various characters, a tourist who comes through town, a man on a date, a landscaper at the hospital, and so on and so forth. And that's the men. The women, Mary Swanson is played by Quinlan Fitzgerald, and the librarian played by Blythe Foster. Quinn is a senior, and Blythe is a graduate student here who she's really a lovely actress. She got her MFA at Columbia in their theater program there, and then has worked regionally for several years before coming back to graduate school. And then we have various other, Madison Scarborough plays a female tourist, a woman on a date, etc. Soren McVeigh plays a female doctor, and the aunt, Joray Ann Bruton, plays a tour guide, a hospital attendant, etc. And then there's a wonderful character played by Gabriel Corte, who is called Sweetheart, who shows up in the theater audience and kind of run. I won't give it all away, but she becomes involved in the theatrical activities on stage.
Mm. Is this meta dimension?
Yeah, meta dimension. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Huh.
Eno is known for the play Tom Paine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Mitchell Thomas?
I did, and I loved it. Yeah, I thought he was wonderful. Yeah.
So, Tom Paine, you have this existential anxiety about life. You have dealings with mortality, with failure. Mm-hmm. And you have this sense where his anxiety becomes inflamed into antagonism, obnoxiousness. And he's assaulting the fourth wall. It wasn't my favorite play, to tell you the truth. I was a little baffled by it.
Yeah.
Although nobody would have known it because I was laughing pretty hard through the whole thing. But what do you think about, what does Tom Paine say about Eno's writing, and how does that play into what you see in Middletown?
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. I think the thing that they probably both have in common is this post-Beckett influence, where if you think about Waiting for Godot, you know, Beckett's most famous play, you've got essentially two bums who are somewhere on the heath or whatever it is, under a tree, and waiting for Godot, who some people say is God or whatever, but anyway, they're waiting for this fellow who doesn't show up, and they're not quite sure why they're there, except they kind of popped into existence there. They have a vague memory, perhaps, of previous life, and they really have to kind of invent themselves as they go along. And I think that the Tom Paine play is a little bit like that. It's a little Beckettish in that way, in that you have a fellow who is somehow has greatness thrust upon him as he finds himself on stage without knowing why he is there or what he is supposed to say, and perhaps not really being sure of exactly who he is. And then he has to kind of invent himself in a very strange way vis-a-vis this audience that he's suddenly confronted with. Middletown is much more gentle play, I think, than Tom Paine. But there probably is still that feeling of people finding themselves in the awkwardness that is life and not really having all the answers about what they should do and who they are and all that. So I think there's a kind of there's a kind of similarity there. There's John Dodge also has this great line, and I'm not sure I'm getting it exactly right, but he's talking about his constant anxiety attacks, and he says, I have this tremendous anxiety, and it attacks all the time. In fact, that's how I keep in shape. So there's something that we can connect with, I think, because we all have that. You know, we all wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go, what am I doing? Or what should I be doing? I have this feeling I ought to be doing something that I'm not.
So it seems like Eno's an interesting character. He sort of seems, you know, sui generis. I was looking at his bio, and he went to high school in Concord, which is interesting, considering the great literary tradition out of Concord.
Right.
And then he was in Amherst for three years, and they dropped out, and he's kind of. Made his way, but he has there seems to be this desire for authenticity.
Yeah.
And it seems he has a belief that there is a life underneath the surfaces, the norms and and the etiquette that we have. And he wants to peel that back and say, actually, this isn't it. This is it down here, the bedrock.
Right.
And I, you know, my being exposed to Tom Paine, you know, my thought was that when he strips it away underneath, he's very cynical about whether there is meaning or not. And I wondered, you know, of course, Wilder in our town is doing that, but he seems to be showing there's a spiritual or cosmic dimension of wonder that is there. And I wonder, in Middletown, is Eno a cynic? Is he being positive? Is he leaving it up to us? Is that part of the existential anxieties that we have to determine?
Right.
That?
Actually, I think he's being really positive. There's a kind of delicacy to the play and a depth to the play and a awkwardly honest charm to people's actions, I think, which really is very optimistic. Someone was in rehearsal a few nights ago and watched the second act and said, you know, this is what the person said, I'm really moved by the kindnesses that people have shown each other in this play. And I think that's really true. There's a sense that this town, when I started trying to figure this play out, I looked at the characters, and there's a sense in this town that it's almost like a strange family that doesn't know it's a family. The mechanic, who probably hasn't actually fixed a car for a couple weeks, and I'm not sure why he shows up in the public library during the days he may not have a place to go. It really, I think, hasn't figured out quite how to grow up as a person, and there's sort of a feeling to him like, you know, those of us who, when we were in high school, were occasionally told to go sit in the detention hall. You know, it probably feels a little like, life feels a little like that to him. Of, you know, I really want to be loved and understood and to be somebody, but I don't know how to move forward. The librarian is really kind of, I think this is a Virginia Woolf phrase, but the mother of us all, in a way. She sort of is a nurturing figure in town. The cop is sort of, he says he has his moods, and he certainly does, but I think he kind of feels, you know, how am I supposed to make these people behave? You know, this boy, that is this mechanic, you know, he goes and writes a dirty word on the stop sign at the edge of town, right? And then he sits drinking in the park at night. How am I supposed to, you know? So there's that kind of thing going on. There's a strange kind of reverence that the librarian has for Greg the astronaut, who has, she says, this terribly limited vocabulary, because he just has to say Houston this and Houston that, you know. But he has one of these haircuts, she says, you know, one of these, you know, she obviously is smitten with him, you know? and but all up there, way so that he can see the earth and he can see the whole of life, and he is seeing all this mystery that none of us can see. And then all he's allowed to say is Houston this and Houston that, you know. So there's a kind of sweetness, I think, about this play that is not really in Tom Paine. Tom Paine, I think, is more savage, mm-hmm. in a way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that there aren't conflicts in this play and, you know, moments of theatrical battle and all that kind of stuff, but I think that it really is kind of about, you know, one interview that I saw with Eno, he said, you know, it's really about how we're all human beings, and it's really about life as a human being. And he says something like, you know, I think life as a human being is really a pretty terrific thing, you know, when you think about it.
Right.
You know. And so I think that he's coming from that kind of positivism. The other thing I would say is that there is something sort of Shakespearean about this play, and it's buried, but I think it's there. You know, Romeo and Juliet, they say, two houses both alike in dignity, the Juliet's family and his family. Well, this also has two houses both alike in dignity. It's John Dodge's house on one side of the stage and Mary's house on the other. The scene outside the hospital in the second act, with the landscaper planting essentially what is, if you want to be a little sappy about it, the tree of life in the middle of the stage, is a little bit like the gravedigger in Hamlet. And as a matter of fact, he finds a rock and he pulls it out and he says, I never know if I'm going to find a rock or a skull, and he holds it up and says, alas, you know. And, and the opening of the play, the public speaker has a long kind of introduction where he welcomes everyone. No, I mean, he has this litany of you know, a page-long litany of people that he wants to welcome, you know, and they range from, you know, the local merchants to people who are getting headaches because they are trying so hard to attach significance to everything, you know, or the people who are slowly dying and slowly graying, which really is all of us. And I think under that speech, there's a little bit of the seven ages of man, you know, that we all have this universal journey, and we all play out our roles vis-a-vis each other. But there is, so I think that, you know, in a strange way, this is one of those plays about, you know, you can say, compared with Wilder, is there an order to the cosmos? Is there a pattern? But I think there is a pattern. It's just that we can't quite know it. You know, that there's a mystery that we can't see from where we are.
And it sounds like there's a populist stripe in him, a democratic sensibility, inclusiveness.
He's
shining light on. There's a line in there. I don't know who says it. It's not rare, but it's very lucky to be a person,
right?
Just a regular person,
right? Right. And I think there's a kind of, we were talking about that line in rehearsal last week, and one of the actresses said, you know, all of us, and she said, I don't think it's limited to artists, but, you know, maybe I feel it that way. You know, we have this constant anxiety about, you know, are we doing enough? Are we special? Are we making our mark? Are we impressing? And this starts when we're a little kid, you know, and it really runs and chases us through life. And, you know, I think part of the play is saying, not that any of that is wrong. I'm sure Eno has felt that himself. But that there is maybe, that we are enough because of who we are. That on some level we are enough.
What is it about small town America, the mythical little town, that draws the attention of playwrights the way it does?
Wow. And short story writers. Weinsberg, Ohio. Is it Weinsberg, Ohio? Am I remembering that right? What's her name from the...
I mean, really existed, you know? It's certainly... You know, you wouldn't find very many towns that come close to it today, although I was in North Dakota this summer.
Right.
Some areas there that...
Right.
But still, they have their high-speed internet.
And in that way, this town, I think, is sort of timeless. I suppose it's a kind of petri dish. Is that what it is? A small place where a culture can be, and where you get you can find people who are individuated but who are connected in ways that maybe we're not in.
You can control the culture.
Control the culture. Yeah.
I wondered if it occurred to me. I wonder if part of it is them, authors and playwrights wondering if we got it right in. Or if we didn't get it right, and how it could be revisioned if we did, or why do they want to go back there and tinker and have a run? I mean, part of this comes to me because you hear The Greatest Generation looking back and saying, you know, oh, those were the good old days, we had it right. But of course, they didn't have it all right. Otherwise, this wouldn't have come from it.
I wonder
sometimes if they're interested in going back and saying, actually, underneath the surface here, these dysfunctions exist.
Right. I think so. I think that under the surface there are dysfunctions, and that is part of the part of this play and part of that small town world. I think, you know, you get a kind of Norman Rockwell surface, and then you peel that away, it's not quite that.
It's not quite that.
Yeah.
Charles Isherwood's famous review of the 2010 New York production He says, characters are word-woozy poet-philosophers who dispense piercing observations about life, death, and the cosmos.
Yeah.
Does it walk a fine line between about believability, about the words that are coming out of these people's mouths?
You know, yeah, in a way. Perhaps not quite so much as the play with Mitch, but Eno really has a voice which is his own. On the other hand, I think you just have to kind of posit that these are people who talk this way and let it happen. Here's a note that Eno writes about this issue. He says, a general note on the play. The first and probably most important thing is that the characters should sound, as in most plays, like normal human beings talking. There's some philosophy in the play, and even perhaps some poetry, but the characters in the play are mainly speaking off the top of their heads, sometimes thinking out loud, perhaps sometimes seeking to share or clarify a thought they've been having. A serious and simple and kind of matter-of-fact delivery is probably best. Of course, there are moments of emotional difficulty, a yearning, wonderment, etc., but in general, I think the play should move along at a pretty good clip, like life.
Reading the descriptions of this production,
right.
I thought of another sort of small town play, which was These Shining Lives.
Oh, right, yes, yeah.
And I wondered, are you, Tom, attracted to that theme in particular of the... Now, I know they're very different.
Yeah, they are very
but you
different.
Still, but you yeah. still have the way the characters yeah. and the relations were played out
right.
in the small town that brought the...
Right,
you know.
Right, right, yeah. That's a good question. I don't know how many of the plays I've done in my life have really been set in small towns, but you know, there is a kind of, what I would say that there is, to my mind, in common between those two plays is a kind of human reality and social reality, and then a kind of spiritual reality which contains that or goes beyond it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that with These Shining Lives because, you know, on one level it's obviously a docudrama, but I think it's kind of a poetic docudrama and not limited to, you know, agitprop or simply arguments or whatever. And somehow in that play, you know, the women being connected spiritually and you know, even at the end of the play, all the women other than them who have died from this radiation, you know, being like stars in the sky and so on and so forth. There's a kind of place that the play and the characters have in a spiritual reality, I guess. And I think that's true of this play, mm-hmm. this play also. Or at least it seems that way to me, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you know if Eno has been affected by Concord writers like Emerson or Thoreau or do you know?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me, but there would be no reason, I guess, objectively he should be necessarily. But I do think there's a kind of deep humanism and a sense of. A sense of human being coming out of nature that is part of those writers. The cop has a great line in this play where he says, the human being is a lovely animal, dark, you know. Mm. And of course, that's his cop mind, you know, ticking away and so on and so forth. But there's something I think about human life as part of nature and those unanswerable questions about how is it, how do we distinguish ourselves from other parts of nature? And yet, the female doctor says to John Dodge when he becomes a patient, he says, how ironic that I'm here. And she said, you know, irony is a people thing. Nature is very frank.
Mm.
You know? So again, there's that kind of thing where you've got the creature which is able to create poetry and able to love in ways that maybe other creatures aren't in that self-aware way, and yet is inescapably part of the fabric of nature, and is so maybe that, I don't know, Concord at that period of time. And
it's so impressive the way that he can take Middle America and then bring in these deep issues about existence, about the definition of a human being.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, not offering answers, but propelling questions. There seems to be something quintessentially American about this play. It doesn't seem like it could have come out of Europe or England.
No, I agree. I agree. Yeah. No, I think it is, and I think there's an I don't know how open we are as a society now and where we're going, but at its best, there's a kind of openness to America and to, you know, American, just the stance, the thought, you know. The other thing I mentioned that the opening, the speakers, public speakers' opening, welcoming speech to the audience has, I think, some Shakespeare and the Ages of Man in it, but it also has, I think, Whitman in it, that, you know, and the part of Whitman that says, I contain multitudes, and we all are a multitude which is one. Mm-hmm. You know, I won't read all of this because it is long, but it starts out, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed colleagues, members of the board, local dignitaries, everyone, really, stockbrokers, dock workers, celebrities, nobodies, ladies, gentlemen, all comers, newcomers, the newly departed, the poorly depicted, people who are still teething, who are looking for a helping verb, you know.
That's incredible. That sounds just like Whitman.
Yeah,
that kind of long list of,
Yeah.
I mean, his Song of Occupations or whatever
it
might be, you know.
Right, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And it's a kind of, and later on he says, you know, welcome to this celebration, that this dream lived with open eyes, and then he says closed eyes, and so on and so forth. But it, you know, it reminds me of Prospero and We Are Such Stuff as Dreams Are Made On, but he's also talking, obviously, about the event of the play, but about life itself. And it's been very interesting, you know, talking with the actor who's doing that monologue and trying to find the ways that these things weave in, you know, with each other.
It must be gratifying to watch the changes that occur, that a production like this does to these young actors.
Very much so. Yeah. I wouldn't say this of every play that I've directed, but I think the other day in rehearsal, we were sitting around talking at the end of rehearsal, and I said, I know that you all and we all are in love with this play. And they all just nodded. Mm-hmm. They all just said, yes, we are, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that is, it's the kind of play that I think can be transformative for these young actors, and a kind of play that almost demands a kind of surrender in approaching it. Very early on, I was talking with the actor who's playing John Dodge, and we were talking about how some of his moments as a character where he is, you know, dealing with some kind of humiliation, or he ends up in the hospital, completely from, as a result of his own actions, and his arc in the play and Mary's arc in the play really form his goes down like that and hers goes up like that, and so we were talking about how there's almost a kind of really awkward honesty about the writing and about the characters, and that you can't get there as an actor by saying, you know, I know how to do this. I'm going to go through this with all kinds of pizzazz, and you know, everybody's going to like what I'm doing, and so on and so forth. You have to kind of go like, wait a second, I don't know what to do. I'm in the face of, you know, this place that I may have experienced in my life and everybody may have experienced, where I just feel, I'm confessing to you that I feel awkward about this. I don't know how to find my way out of this, you know? And so I think there's a kind of way that the actors have had to just kind of give themselves to the material and find themselves in the material, rather than saying, oh yes, I know what my story is here, I can, you know, I can go through it with verve and it will work.
How did Middletown capture your attention? When did that happen?
I have never seen the play.
Oh,
I hadn't read it. I'd heard about the New York production, and I was looking for plays this year with, we have a, we can't always do fairly large cast plays, but we like to be able to do them and give everybody a shot at really participating. And this has a cast of 12. I cast it with 12, which is fairly large, unless you do a classic. And now, of course, contemporary playwrights are writing, you know, 3 and 4 character plays at the largest.
That's because they know they'll never get them produced.
That's
They're too
right.
expensive otherwise.
They're too expensive.
Yeah.
And so this is something of a delicious anomaly. And then I read it and I thought, you know, it really is a... it's a beautiful piece and something that would be great for the students in our pre-professional program to work on. And the other thing that happened was that as I was reading this last spring, and they're tangentially connected, but they made a connection for me somehow, is that the shooting in Isla Vista happened, and it just knocked everybody back, you know, off our chairs, you know. And there was a lot of rawness, understandably. In our building, perhaps as much as any, since we're right next to Isla Vista and so on and so forth. And I wrote Will Eno and I said, actually the play was in the middle of being moved from Eno's agent in New York to Samuel French, and it was sort of like lost in the paper shuffle, and Samuel French couldn't give us the rights, and I'd been talking with his agent, and I finally wrote to him, and I said, you know, we would really love to do your beautiful play, and I think it would be great for our actors in training, and I said, and also, you know, this thing has just happened in Isla Vista, and I said, you know, I think it would be really a very healing experience to be able to do something which was essentially about these human kindnesses and about, you know, people working out their their lumpy relationships with each other in a vista which includes tacitly some kind of spiritual level.
Did he respond?
Yeah, he was wonderful.
So it was because of his direct involvement that you're doing it.
Yeah, exactly. No, and he wrote back and he said, he was lovely, and he said something like, thank you for your very kind letter, and then he said, I have actually visited Santa Barbara and it's a beautiful place, and he said, I was so sorry to hear what has happened. He said, of course we can make this happen, you know, and I was so grateful. And then he said, you know, feel free to write me and so on and so forth. So everything that one sees, you know, if one sees him in a spoken interview or reads, you know, it comes across in his letter, and you just get the feeling of a man who is understated, modest, extremely intelligent, and almost studiedly unpretentious.
Are there advantages to staging a play that you have never seen produced?
Yeah. There are probably advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that you have to find your own way and that you can't rely on anything you've seen or, oh yes, I remember that scene and it worked so well because this and this was true about it. So there are advantages. Those are the same things as the disadvantages. You have to find your own way. Oftentimes, you know, I've directed a lot of Shakespeare at festivals and stuff, and so what I have done oftentimes in that kind of situation is I'll go and look at a taped production of, it could be the BBC, it could be, you know, but one of those productions which is just kind of thrown together for educational purposes, and then I'll look at that and I'll say, okay, why isn't this working for me? And that will force me then to say what I think the thing is about, you know. So, but the hard part is when you see something that is just so well done. Many years ago, I did Cloud Nine, but I don't. It was when I did Cloud Nine. That was at least 10, maybe 15 years after I saw Tommy Tune's wonderful production in New York. And that's the hard thing when you see something that is just knocks your socks off, mm-hmm. and you say, I can't imagine another way to do that, then you're in trouble.
Have you ever done a play that you hadn't seen before, and then sometime later seen someone else's production of it, and seen some brilliant way they solved a particular problem that you struggled with, and said, oh, that's mm-hmm. so easy. I went like this, and all I had to do was do that.
Yeah, sure.
I suppose
And it can be a moment of character development. It can be just a little staging thing.
And I suppose the other is true as well. You could say, oh, that doesn't work. You know, the way we did it.
Or what is really interesting to me is you do something and then you see a production and you say, isn't it funny? We found the same ways to handle things, unknowing. Right? Never having, the productions had no contact. But in other words, there's something in the structure of the script here that really asks for this kind of thing. And this staging is almost the same or that, whatever it is,
right.
Some element.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Unwritten.
Right.
Unwritten structure that,
right.
Logic that forces it.
Right, that comes out of it. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Tom Ritter, for being with me today on Direct Talk. And we're really looking forward to Middletown.
Great.
Mid-November.
Great.
Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Direct Talk Radio, conversations with directors and artists in the performing arts. For more information about this program, to listen to archives, or to communicate with me, Joseph Miller, visit www.therightjoe.com. That's THEWRITEJOE. For more information and tickets to the UCSB Department of Theater and Dance's production of Middletown, visit www.theaterdance.ucsb.edu. Thanks for listening.